So my question is for Mr. Hultzman. In his last slide, he made a conclusion that polytheism and relativism emerges from coercive democracy, and I just wanted him to expand on the causality here. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I must say, it was a very hypothetical statement. I just took it from empirical reality. The Greek republics were typically characterized by polytheism, and I mentioned that Socrates, Plato, Aristotle revolted precisely against this. Find the same thing in Rome. We find the same thing within the Germanic tribes and elsewhere. And I think the connection is that the appeal to religious authority, which were typically ancestors, right? So it's this book by Fustel de Coulanges in the 19th century, right, on the city of antiquity, right, in which he describes the religious sentiments of the Romans and Greeks and so on. It was an ancestor cult, essentially. So how does it come that people come to refer to the same authorities? And I think it's a consequence that results from discussing things eventually. So it's a kind of philosophical enterprise. It's more led, through exchange, discussion, and so on, and which was concentrated in Athens as an intellectual center. So you get this kind of result. But in a free society, it emerges slowly, right? It comes essentially in a slow process. And it can be accelerated or also imposed by monarchical political coups, right? A monarchy would typically prefer a monotheistic regime. And that's why in the Christian Middle Ages and then also in the early modern period, monotheism was considered to be a characteristic feature of a civilization. And people have brought it to realize, well, there's only this one God. Right? So I think that to the extent that society under the pressure of the democratic forces that I've described, coercive democracy, revolves back to a more primitive state, well, it becomes more natural that, people settle back to some sort of relativism and polytheism because they are no longer interested in questions of truth, right? The decisive question is always one of decision and of compromise. So then you don't spend time on the question of truth. Is it true that there is only one God? But the question is, okay, I mean, you believe in this God, I believe in this God. What the heck? Okay, let them include all in our pantheon and everyone here has his place so we make everybody happy. That I think that's the praxeological argument I would propose.
My question's for Saif, or I guess if anyone else cares to answer. So could you, I guess this is coming from an American perspective, but could you comment on interest rates, I guess, over the last decade, what your impression is and where, if there wasn't a central bank, where the market interest rates, I guess, how they might have behaved differently?
So I think it's very difficult to pass judgment on interest rates in a fiat environment because they are the products of central planning. So central banks basically decide the interest rate because they buy and sell bonds in a way that brings about the interest rate that they want. And of course, they have a monopoly on the creation of the money, or at least they and their banks have a monopoly on the creation of the money. So they can control the money supply, they can control the price of money, and so they can impose an interest rate on society effectively, like a situation of price controls. So it's a bit like trying to guess what would be the price of potatoes in a situation where you have a central planning board for potatoes. It's difficult to tell because if the central planning board wasn't there, then the entire potato industry would be quite different. So the answer that I would say is I wouldn't have clear answers to specific short-term interest rates. I wouldn't be able to tell you that, you know, in the year 2000, interest rates should have been at 6%, but they were actually at 3 or something of the sort. I don't think you can make something like that because it's a constantly shifting policy that the central bank follows. But I would imagine that if there hadn't been a central bank, then you would have hard money, so you wouldn't have inflation, and so people would have a lot lower time preference. And so interest rates would likely decline over time. And I mean, it depends on when in your hypothetical you want to not have the central bank. Should we just not have central banks from day one, or we got rid of them last week? So it depends. But you know, the longer we've had without central banks, then I would imagine the lower interest rate would go, I think.
Well, I would like to add that in a fiat money regime, the market's interest rate would be lower than it would be in the absence of a fiat money system. Because in a fiat money system, as you know, banks create money through lending, so they increase the credit supply, push down the market interest rate below the level that would prevail without such an increase in bank credit in the absence of such an expansion of bank credit. So possibly the idea would lead to the conclusion interest rate would be somewhat higher than they are under current conditions. But then the world would look very different. Maybe there would be tremendous changes when it comes to savings and investment demand. So it's really hard to say where the interest rate would be. My take would be interest rate would be somewhat higher.
Yeah, under the current regime, of course, you can make negative interest rates because you can always recover your losses by printing up additional sums of money. So even though the rate is below zero, if you are in position of the institution that produces money, losses are not losses in the same sense as they would be for private individuals.
I have a question for Saif Dien. So you're saying that in the process of civilization, the social time preference rate falls, and at some point it reaches, or the nominal interest rate reaches a level where it equals the cost of money storage and the risk of losing it. But what about the risk premium and the nominal interest rate? Would that not prevent ever falling the nominal interest rate to the level of the cost of holding money?
I mean, I think there is a risk premium on lending the money. There's also a risk premium on keeping the money. So it's entirely conceivable that the risk also declines. So there's the cost of holding the money and the risk of holding the money. And then there's the cost of lending it. Now, with time, and as time preference drops, you would expect that the risk of default and the risk of taking the money and running away would also keep declining over time, because people are lower time preference, more likely to commit to their contracts. So I'd still think the more we lower our time preference, eventually the time preference needs to go below the cost of storage.
Well, I think you do not even have to come up with the idea of storage costs. You just have to think about the deflationary monetary regime. Let's say prices decline by 2% over time. So that would be a negative inflation premium in the nominal interest rate. And if the underlying real interest rate would correspond with a positive sign with the decline in prices, then you can have a nominal zero interest rate, but in real terms, you have a positive real interest rate. That's perfectly imaginable.
I think, I mean, if you invest, right, so there must always be an incentive, right, for you to forego the benefits of having cash on hand. That is, even if you have a price deflationary situation, right, in real terms you earn 2%, so in order to entice you to give up your liquidity and invest in a project, you need to be paid more, so you need to have more than 2%, right? I mean, the cost of holding money, yes, it's true, they come into play. Why do people, I mean, right now it's also costly to hold money. Why do people still hold money? Because there are non-monetary benefits that are related with
holding cash, right? You're benefiting from liquidity, you're benefiting from a good that has no counterparty risk and stuff like this. Right? That's why people hold cash, and investors today hold a lot of cash.
Even though the rumors.
Yeah, because if something of contingency arrives in the meantime, you still have control over the money. That is one of the reasons why people don't want to give up their money. The motive for holding money is, on one hand, some sort of insurance against uncertainty, and holding money makes it easier to deal with uncertainty. Though I'm also somewhat skeptical about this idea that the interest rate could fall to zero. It means something that, okay, if I loan the money for a year to somebody, what happens if something happens in that 1 year and I urgently need the money, but I have loaned it out? So holding money ensures you against any type of contingency that arises in the meantime, and to give that up, you would want to have a reward for this, because you give up this possibility of dealing with unforeseen contingency for the duration of the loan that has been extended.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that under current conditions, the major concern we all should have is that central banks keep pushing down interest rates, manipulating credit markets to, you know, get a boom going, an artificial boom that causes overconsumption and malinvestment. And we see that last Thursday, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates by 50 basis points, and the European Central Bank has slashed interest rates, and we are at the beginning, I think, of another huge, big interest rate cutting cycle, and causing, of course, again, overconsumption, malinvestment. So we might not, well, pretty soon we might be confronted with the situation where interest rates again approach the zero line. Of course, that is an indication in the current fiat money regime that other problems, other crises will follow.
But I think the likelihood that we'll stay in extended zero interest rate territory is diminishing, because of the Ukraine conflict and all the financial warfare has been led against Russia and all supporters of Russia. There are now a lot of countries that have alternatives to the SWIFT payment system and to European financial markets. Right? So we've been digging our own graves. Right? The reason why low interest rates could be maintained for such a long period, or more than 10 years actually in some countries, was the lack of any alternatives. And we have been building alternatives in the past few years. So this is just, but I mean, I agree with your general assessment, but I think, I mean, the happy times for our central banks are becoming shorter.
Thank you. Something more to add to that interest question. If you look at the components of nominal interest, then low time preference and hard money certainly will lead to the disappearance of the purchasing power premium. Maybe not so sure the terms of trade premium that Rothbard came up with. And one thing that will not disappear is the risk premium, if you see it as the perceived risk of not being paid back. So I think there's not only low time preference and hard money needed, but also trust. I think you have to add trust in the picture, societal trust, to get that component to zero. And I would suggest that Guido's theory of originary interest is there probably a bit of a better fit. Guido's theory of originary interest, because he gave the example of giving a zero interest loan to family and friends. And I don't think that's only explainable or easiest or best explainable by low time preference. I think Guido's suggestion that it may be due to less of a spread between means and ends, meaning that it can be an end in itself for you to provide family and friends without the premium, is a better measure, better explanation for that. So I would try to take that into account when figuring how it could drop to zero. And I think there also trust plays again an important role.
I would say yes. I think that's a good point to include the trust component, but I would say it's also proxied, if you want, by time preference, because the lower time preference, the more trustworthy people are. And I would say that ultimately the more you accumulate cash balances, the more the utility of a cash balance diminishes. I should have perhaps specified this in detail, but the utility of money is the thing that has the least diminishing marginal utility, because you can exchange it easily for everything else. But its utility still diminishes. Your first dollar is not as valuable as when you go from $100 million to $100 million and $1. So the first dollar is obviously much more valuable. So the marginal utility of money diminishes. And after a while, the more money you accumulate, you see the benefit from diversification away from holding the money yourself, because then if your money gets compromised or stolen, all of it gets compromised or stolen, but you could diversify by lending to others. So you would see that how the marginal utility of lending can be positive for the case that you mentioned, which is that you get some value from lending to others at no interest, but also to diversify from having all of your money in one place.
The interest rate is extremely interesting. It's an extremely interesting economic phenomena. And I think it's very important to, and this is just a side comment, to make a distinction. When you look at the market interest rate, it consists of various components. And one component is called the originary interest rate. And that is actually the really interesting component of the market interest rate. The nominal market interest rate depends on many factors, depending on certain conditions, on regimes. But I just wanted to remind ourselves that, for instance, Murray Rothbard and in particular Ludwig von Mises came up with this pure time preference theory. And he says that the originary interest rate, which is in you and me, it cannot go away, it cannot fall to zero, let alone become negative. So whenever interest rates become very low and central banks start manipulating credit markets, that is a clear indication that there is a distortion coming. And because we know, for axiological reasons, that the originary interest rate can never fall to zero.
Guido, you have some comments?
No, I'm perfectly. Then it would get technical, because. But I agree with the way Torsten put it. Very diplomatic.
All Austrians agree, right? There's a pure component of the interest rate, and which makes that so the market interest rate is unlikely to fall to zero, right? So what is the cause of the pure interest rate? And I've argued in various works that it is the value spread between means and ends. Right. If we use any means necessarily, the purpose of the means is to help us reach the end, so it derives its value from the end. Necessarily, the means must have a lower value than the end. Right. So that's really at the origin. And I've criticized the time preference theory of the interest rate, which I believe both in the Bernbachian version and in the Misesian version do not really explain that pure component of the time reference. But I would be happy not to go into this. But you can read the paper, it's online. It's a 2002 paper with the title A Theory of Interest. Okay.
You mean the one where the means are the end?
The means in the case of the family loan, right, can be the end. So in that case, there's no interest rate.
Yeah, if there's no more interest.
Zero interest.
Professor Halpa, thank you for your presentation. Switching gears a little bit towards your use of the Pareto Principle 2080, can you elaborate a little further? If that's just a general rule of thumb, can you imagine a scenario where there's a more committed hardcore element that maybe less than 20% is required?
No, this Pareto rule is just a rule of thumb. So that is, of course, a speculation. It makes some sort of sense. The basic idea is simply that most of the work is done by very few people. They get the result done, and the bulk of the people, they don't count. They just follow along. But that is not a strict law or anything like that. I only thought that might be a useful guide to assess certain situations. But it is the Pareto rule is not strictly speaking a law.
My question, actually, I'm going to repeat my question. We already discussed this privately to Professor Hulsman, and also second part is for Professor Hoppe. Is it possible, or is a non-coercive democracy possible? And if it is, to what extent it can be maintained in a natural order? That's the second part of the question.
Yeah. I think if you recall what I said about the natural order, if that natural order is in place, then you basically have a non-coercive democracy. Numerous organizations that are democratically organized, for instance, but you can exit. So the coercive democracy. The most fundamental criterion of it is there is no exit option. You are indeed the monopolist, and everybody is participating in whatever the monopolist says. No exit option.
It's a very good question. And the empirical work of Cochin, to which I've referred, shows that, I mean, so they had, even in these debating societies, in these intellectual clubs, they had recourse to internal pressure and even social pressure outside of the club, for people who would not conform to the decisions that had been taken internally. So it shows that, I mean, in a market economy, the beauty is that you have partial agreements, as I said, right? And that's always possible. I mean, the most difficult case in practice, which shows that you can go beyond this, is marriage. At least, let's say, so I don't know exactly how it is in Islam, but in the Christian marriage is really an open-ended engagement, a mutual obligation. That's a tough one. I mean, you just look at the divorce rates. I mean, you see how difficult it is to keep this up in practice. But so that's really the only exception that I see, and it's just two persons. Right? So as soon as you have many persons, and as soon as the engagement is no longer just limited, it's virtually impossible that you get some sort of a voting democracy, not in the Misesian, Fetterian sense of a process democracy, but a voting democracy going, I just don't see it. I think it's completely unnatural to have such a sort of a, but I may be wrong.
I would like to bring Stefan into the game. I think life starts at conception, and I would believe to be arbitrary to say it starts with birth or at 8 months or something like this. I don't think the fetus is a trespasser, because a trespasser is responsible for being there where he should not be. And where is the fetus supposed to be if not where the fetus is. So I see it more like a boat in the ocean, and let's say a one-year child suddenly appears on your boat. Do you have the right to throw it out? I don't think so.
Well, I don't know if lifeboat scenarios are always the best way to analyze these things, but in pregnancy, which is a normal thing, I agree. I think Walter Block is incorrect in calling the fetus a trespasser. It's clearly invited, at least in most cases, by the voluntary actions of the parents. To me, the question is, so if the mother has the right to terminate the pregnancy early on, it's not because it's a trespasser, it's because we would say that the fetus doesn't have rights yet. But we would say in the later stages of pregnancy, we deem the fetus to have rights. And at that point, the mother has positive obligations to the baby, including keeping it alive. So that's the basic argument. My entire argument is like, that's one way to look at it. And everyone's going to have different opinions. So ultimately, I think the right answer legally is to just bring the jurisdiction down to the family level, and then they make the decision. And then the law that governs is the law of the mother and the family, right? And so that solves a lot of these disputes. You just basically, yeah, go ahead, Guido.
May I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
Okay, so let's say, so two men and women get together and they make a child, right? And then they make the public declaration, yes, we wish this child to be there and they're so happy and so on. Does this child have a right to exist in the body of the woman?
In my opinion, you can make an argument that it does, but then that's a separate question from the jurisdiction question. Okay. So I would say that in the late stages of pregnancy, if there's no serious health problem, the mother would be wrong to go through with an abortion, but she's the jurisdiction, so that's the answer.
Yeah, I mean, but the question is, your argument is the baby is not a carrier of a right as long as it's a fetus.
No, that's not my argument.
But that's what you just said.
No, I think that in the later stages of pregnancy, you could argue the fetus does have rights, and the mother has the right to not kill it.
But what's the origin? What's the cause of the rights? Where do the rights come from?
The potential for rationality, reason.
But the potential is there right from day one.
I agree. I know it's not an easy issue.
Yeah, but his question is to me, so what do you do if somebody has an abortion? Do you treat that as murder? Would you then be in favor of whatever, executing the woman or executing the doctor that assisted? I think you will. I mean, we, as libertarians, we also have to be somehow reasonable people. So you will not find anybody who said somebody has an abortion, that woman now must be killed, or must be incarcerated, a lifelong incarceration for the woman. That is the only thing that concerned Stefan, as far as I'm concerned. We can call that whatever we want. The question is, what do we do about it when it occurs? And I don't think you will get some sort of significant majority anywhere in the world that would say the doctor and the woman now have to be killed, executed, incarcerated, lifelong. Even apart from things like rape and all those sorts of problems. So it doesn't really matter what you call it. What do you do if it occurs? And I don't think you would plead this should be treated just like the case where you murder me or I murder you.
No, I would not throw the first one.
What? Okay.
but of course, under Walter Block's theory, the woman
Mike.
No, I was saying under Walter's theory, if a woman is a surrogate pregnant woman and she aborted the baby, she's now violating a property crime against her slave owner. So maybe he could put her in prison, according to his theory. which shows how, I think, crazy it is.
Well, but then, yeah, I mean, I see the point. I agree in principle. But, I mean, now looking at practice again, right, there is a huge difference between a woman who out of desperation aborts, okay, and she's torn and so on, and who would wish to punish her? But, I mean, there are also ladies who do this routinely, right? Who are just, I mean, they go on a vacation. They, oh, yeah, the vacation is on the wrong date, so I need to have a date at the hospital first and get an abortion. I mean, this is, sorry, I mean, for me, this is criminal. This is really, and there must be some sanction there.
But what would this, what is a sanction?
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a few short comment about the idea that the fetus can be invited by the mother. I don't think so, because if you invite someone, he must accept the invitation, and the fetus did not accept any invitation whatsoever, so the analogy I don't think works well.
Yeah, actually that's one of Walter Block's disagreements with me. He thinks that the fetus can't be an invitee. Like normally, we're all invitees here, and you could make an argument that if you invite someone to your home for dinner and there's a storm that pops up, you can't just kick them out and make them die. That there's like an implicit condition that you have to harbor them for a while, right, in times of peril. And Walter's argument is that, well, the fetus doesn't exist at the time of the Creation Act, and therefore there's no, can be no contract. But that's not, you know, the Rothbard theory of contract is a title transfer theory of contract, and it views contract not as binding obligations as everyone thinks of them, but it's simply transfers of title to property. So contracts have nothing to do with binding obligations. What it has to do with is causation. The element is causation. So the, you know, for example, if I plant a bomb under the in the woods by a tree in the unknown woods, hoping that some child someday will walk across it, a landmine, let's say, and die. When I do this, and 2 years later, this little child who wasn't even born the day I committed the act, I think I'm still responsible for what happened, right? Because it's my action that caused the damage to the kid. So the question is a question of responsibility for one's actions. It's not a contract issue. So I think when you create a child which is naturally in the state of dependency upon the parents, that gives rise to the obligation to support the child, and that would include not killing it if you don't have a good reason to. Which is why I think you could classify late-term abortion as murder, but then the question is who should have jurisdiction over that. So that's why the jurisdiction issue arises.
And as far as having to care for the child, because it is your product, the question is then, of course, where, again, no clear-cut answer exists, for how long does that obligation last? I mean, if you have a kid, for instance, that simply refuses to do anything, just said, I'm your kid, you are responsible for me until I die, and to what extent do you have to support it? I don't think there are certain questions for which there exists no clear-cut answer. There exist questions for which we do have a clear-cut answer, but there exist also certain things where we must say, I don't know what the precise answer is to that question. Do we have to support the kid until it is 6, until it is 7, until it is 80? I hope that my son doesn't expect me to support him until he's I'm 100 years old or something like that. I think that would be a little bit excessive in terms of expectations. You know? Yeah.
I think that in one of my articles, I talk about the reason that courts don't award specific performance in enforcing contracts. They simply say, oh, you've breached the contract, you have to pay monetary damages, is they recognize that some types of contracts or some types of obligations cannot be enforced by an order. And one would be to be a good parent. I mean, if you're such a bad parent that you need a judge to tell you to be a good parent, you're not going to be a good parent. I think the only way it could be manifested would be what the Roman law or the civil law in Europe has in some countries like France and in my home state of Louisiana is what's called forced heirship, which is based upon the idea that, look, if you have a child which is a no account, it's better that you have to take care of the child than society at large and welfare. So I think we could say that. But basically the idea is that every child is entitled to a forced portion of the parent's estate. So it's not like an obligation, it's just the child has a property right in some of the estate because the theory is it's better for the parents to have to take care of the child than the welfare state.
So then you would criticize the American inheritance laws where you have complete control over it and the kids would have no claim to any part of your property.
Yeah, I think you can make some kind of argument that until a certain age, the child has some kind of claim upon part of the parent's estate.
Okay.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind.
Yes, hello. I actually have also a question about the abortion issue. So everybody seems to take it for granted in one way or another that because fetuses have are proto persons, they have a potential to become a true person, a person meaning someone, and if it's an alien or it's a strange animal or it's a human with reasoning capacities and is therefore a legal entity. But I know this argument was first made, I think, by Rothbard, but what was the philosophical foundation? What's the argument for this? Because it is clearly also true that from the moment of conception, this potential is there. So why wouldn't you simply say, well, the whole problem is over if we say only those entities that truly are persons, are legal entities. So it does not include very retarded, like so much that they cannot reason, or demented elderly that really have no reasoning capacities. They are simply not considered legal entities and they do not have rights. I mean, I love my grandmother and I love my dog as well, and I'm not going to kill them simply because I realize that they are not legal entities. I still love them and I still care for them. So why not say that? Why does that make me a bad person for saying this? It's the most logical reasoning, I think.
I think I've done enough damage by arguing for abortion until the ninth month. Instead of now arguing for infanticide. I'll let someone else do that. But as you and I discussed, there is a concept called infanticide, and that means some people do distinguish homicide of a baby with homicide of a functioning adult. And I think in some sense, the Randian view and the sort of rational view, there's something to the idea that rights are for functioning adult humans that are rational. And they have to be primarily for them because everyone else that's dependent depends upon the care from the others, right? So in a sense, I don't want to say they have secondary status. The closest I've found to an interesting discussion of this is in Lauren Lemaski's book, Persons, Rights, and the Moral Community. He's bad on some things, as we know Hans. He's criticized Hans for being an anarchist. But he's got an interesting discussion of why healthy members of a society sort of by charity almost attribute rights to the more marginal members of society, like children or very sick people or retarded people or whatever. And he calls it piggybacking. They piggyback upon the rights of the normal people. I don't know if that works, but I think if we can at least get the rights of it. I mean, one of Rothbard's ways of looking at it was he said, "What the child can run away when he can say, I want to run away. But that implies an older child who has some faculty, right? So I think Rothbard, in a sense, would say that a young child has rights for sure when they can say no, and they can say, I want to run away. Before that, I think this is an area that's everyone disagrees upon.
But argumentative ethics is not applicable to demented elders and to dogs and to children. That's why Rothbard said, let them petition for their rights about animals. So that's very important. We are here in a conference by Hans Hermann Hoppe, who brought argumentative ethics to philosophy together with Frank van Dunne also. But and it does not apply to fetuses and very, very small infants.
Yes, I mean, this question, when do they become legal entities? And Rothbard's idea is, yeah, once a kid can run away from home and go to associate with another family or so, then any obligation that you have to your kid disappear. I mean, most people would probably say, I get that kid back. I mean, again, it depends, of course, on the kid. Maybe with some kids you really say, hey, this person, get the way out, but... I mean, we are again at the point where I have to emphasize again, libertarians do have answers to lots of questions, but we do not have answers to all questions that arise. And then common sense has to come in. We have to just analyze what the situation is. We have to also recognize that there are cultural differences which are not necessarily differences that are of decisive importance, but differences that have to be recognized as existing. Again, the position that Stefan has taken and with which I agree is jurisdiction over these sorts of affairs by and large have to be exercised by the woman and the family. The case that Guido brought up, women who constantly have abortion almost every time and simply do not care, you know, I'm not sure what we would do about people like that either. We would ostracize them. We would think, I mean, these are strange people. We would make any effort that we can do never to give her any donation or lend any support to her. But again, would we incarcerate the woman for how long, forever, or just impose a fine on her? Those are questions that I don't have a patent answer to it. I don't think Guido has a patent answer to all of these. He brings up these questions and and tries to make our life difficult here. But maybe
stainless steel chastity belts.
Yeah, but we have to make sure that she doesn't have the key to the chastity belt. I think there's this Tony DiYazzi, a very important thinker. He said constitutions are institutions like where they do have the key to the chastity belt. That's how valuable constitutions are. I mean, constitutions are supposed to protect us from things. But if the interpretation of the constitution is, again, done by constitutional courts and so forth, then, of course, it is like ladies who have a chastity belt, but at the same time, they also have the key to it. But, again, that it would certainly be a reasonable solution that Guido suggests there. But again, it is not. From what age on would we do that? Does it need 3-4 abortions to do it with a chastity belt, or is one already sufficient? And I'm sure that Guido might be already in favor of just once and chastity belt key is thrown into the ocean, whatever, something like that. As you see, these are interesting questions, and we libertarians are, sensible people. We think about these problems, but we are also modest. We don't know. Guido is less modest than I am, so do I. You know, he with a chastity belt, I thought that's really a good suggestion. But in our next writings, maybe the next year we have somebody talking about the virtue of chastity belts.
I was almost inclined to let this discussion of beating the unborn to death lie, since we've seemed to have crushed the issue, but in a libertarian legal order, we have to think about practical implementation and enforcement. So who has a legitimate claim to be the complainant in this type of case? And then who's going to pay for the surveillance of the prospective mother for 18 years and 9 months, what have you? And without building a police state, is there going to be control on folk remedies that induce abortion and things along those lines? So can we have a little more discussion on the practical aspects of enforcement?
Like also, like who pays for the chastity belt, for instance?
Well, I mean, who would have claims? Most important would, of course, be parents, in particular the father, right? Then the family members, the grandparents might have an interest in having a grandchild, even though the daughter does not agree. Right? So family members, close, extended, and so on. They would be natural people who have a claim against the will of the mother. Then what do you do about this? Well, I mean, of course, you're right. Right? So it creates an impossibility. We're getting into a police state, and therefore we are all reluctant to be specific on this question. It must also be a commonsensical solution. And I think one element that is very important on the way to a solution is just to reinforce the economic necessity of the family. And because currently, with the welfare state, it's very easy for ludicrous young ladies, I mean, you just want to have a lot of fun, they have no responsibility for ourselves, for offspring, and so on. They just have steamy nights and so on, then get pregnant, and then they get rid of the babies and so on. They wouldn't do this without a welfare state because there's no support. Right, so they have a very strong incentive to, well, have people around her take care of her in case she's pregnant in times of need. That's why people typically get married. I mean, that's this open-ended bundle of obligations that you have in a marriage is precisely what is being displaced, more or less, by the welfare state. And to the extent that we can get rid of the welfare state, it would make a comeback. So for me, this is a solution. I mean, we can theorize all we wish. If people get paid for doing stupid things and sometimes evil things, we have a battle up the hill which we cannot win.
Yeah, and for people interested in this issue, there was a book written by Victor Coman. He's a libertarian science fiction writer. It's called Solomon's Knife, and it was maybe 30 years ago, but it's about a future where there's something called transoption, where it's medically possible to actually take a fetus, a young fetus, out of the mother So you wouldn't have to commit suicide. Who knows? That may be coming and might make all this academic. But I would imagine a future humane liberal order, a rational society, libertarian society, would value life. And social stigmas about sex would probably go away. So women wouldn't feel, and there would be markets for baby adoption and for surrogacy. So I think that the incidence of abortion would go way, way, way down in any kind of humane, rational society. So it would be almost a non-problem, I think, in most cases.
However, we're still avoiding the issue in terms of if we're going to label it a crime, who's going to be the complainant? And who's actually going to do the enforcement? And who's paying for those enforcement services?
Hans actually directly addressed that issue in his earlier talk in Romania. And that was part of his point, is like, who's the plaintiff? Now, theoretically, you could say that let's not take babies, let's take just regular victims of, like, children who are victims of abuse and neglect. You know, you could say that if children or parents are abusing their children, then some family members or some strangers could have an agency that would rescue the kid. So they sort of speak on behalf of the kid. If you get to the point where there's a legal presumption that the child wouldn't want these people to be his parents anymore. So theoretically, you could make an argument that you have these rescue agencies, these pro-life rescue agencies that sue on behalf of the child and prosecute the mother for committing abortion. But again, with my solution, they just wouldn't have that right because their jurisdiction would not be able to reach into the family unit. And I think it's obviously too invasive to give this policing power to third parties. How would they know if you're using herbal remedies, if you were not careful enough? So I think that's part of the problem, and it's part of the reason why it should simply not be part of the legal community outside of the family.
Because these refuge agencies would again be liable for crimes that they commit if they make a misjudgment on the case. I mean, they say, oh, this child has been mistreated, I rescue it, and it turns out there was no mistreatment whatsoever. Then you have to have somebody who enforces the verdict against these rescue agencies. That's why I think the most practical thing is it is responsible for of the mother and the father and grandparents and all the rest of it. It is a family affair, and they have to hammer it out what they do.
I was just thinking about the term abortion, which I think is very unfortunate because it's about killing human lives. It's much easier to use the term abortion in a public debate than saying what it really is. Killing of human lives. And it occurs to me, the other day I saw the numbers of abortions in Germany. It's around about 100,000 per year. 100,000 human lives get killed every year. It's very unfortunate. When you think about the world demographics, you see that the number of kids, number of children per mother, that this rate is coming down quite sharply. You need around about 2.1 babies per mother to sustain the population level. We are approaching fast on a global level that number, and there are predictions that sooner or later the rate will be even lower, and that's the path to extinction. It never occurred in human history that world population is actually on a path of extinction. And I think Hans talked about the cultural decline, and I think that is a tremendous problem, and that should advise us to be very, very cautious when it comes to discussing abortion and what to do against it. And so I think it's actually great that the issue gets so much attention in our session.
But again, what Guido said before, we promote this type of culture by having welfare states and all of this, supporting single mothers with lots of children and all of that. But in terms of what we do about it, you just have no answer, just as much as we don't have any answer. We agree, right?
Yeah.
I think we all agree here because we are very agreeable people. And with that remark, I can say we can all agree we should disappear now and continue thinking about chastity belt and similar things while we have some drinks and food. And so I thank you all.